Journey.
The KALW On Air Folk Festival takes place this afternoon, 3 to 8 p.m. It's 5 hours of continuous live music performed here in the KALW studios. Two eclectic bands will kick off the festival, Tribecistan from New York City and Dirty Cello with cellist Rebecca Roudman. We'll also have Celtic music by guitarist Steve Bachman, Old Time with Pete and Ann Sibley, and the festival concludes with Bluegrass by Banjo Master Bill Evans and the Bearcat String Band. Join us for our on-air folk festival, 5 hours of continuous live music starting at 3 today on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. What do you know? Normally heard at this time is Preempted for our special broadcast of the Green Festival coming to you live from the Concourse Pavilion in San Francisco. The time is 12 noon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Welcome to a special broadcast from KALW News. I'm Rose Aguilar.
And I am Ali Razlazan.
And we are broadcasting live from the 12th annual San Francisco Green Festival, the largest festival yet. It's taking place right now at the Concourse Exhibition Center, south of Market at the corner of 8th and Brannan. It's just a short walk from BART and Caltrain. And for the next 2 hours, we'll speak with activists about social justice, sustainability, protecting the planet, and creating green economies. How can we bring these principles into our communities, our politics, and our daily lives?
And we have got a fantastic group of guests lined up to talk to us today, including Doria Robertson, an award-winning community activist from the Richmond Working in Food Justice and Empowering People Within Their Own Neighborhoods. Farah Obeidullah has traveled all the way from the Netherlands to speak on her work in ocean health and industrial fishing taking place in West Africa. And Dana Pearls will stop by to talk about GMO and growing industry of potentially dangerous food products. These are just a few of the activists speaking at the Green Festival this weekend. If you come, be sure to visit the Green Marketplace, which offers products from hundreds of green and socially responsible businesses and organizations, everything from green non-toxic home furnishings to organic clothing to fair trade gifts, children's toys, and food, Rose. Delicious food.
Vegetarian and vegan, all of
yes,
the food.
Yes, and many of them raw.
Yes. And you can visit us after the broadcast. You can also visit KALW this weekend at booth number 715. It's located on the main floor on the left behind the central staircase. Be sure to stop by and say hi. We're going to have volunteers stationed at the booth all weekend. And you can find out more about us at KALW.org. If you'd like more information on the festival, head over to greenfestivals.org. That's Green Festivals with an S. We will be here with 2 hours of live coverage. The festival itself runs today until 7 p.m. and tomorrow from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. One-day admission is $15, $10 for students and seniors, those under 18, bicyclists, members of the Sierra Club, Global Exchange, or Green America can get in for free. You can also get in free if you bring a receipt from Rainbow Grocery.
So we are joining right now. We're going to kick off with Elizabeth O'Donnell, campaign director at Green America, a nonprofit working to build the green economy. Elizabeth leads consumer action campaigns relating to free trade, corporate social responsibility, and GMOs. She has been in charge of many consumer actions, including the Raise the Bar Hershey campaign, which we will talk about in details, which is pushing Hershey to remove child labor from its cocoa supply chain by shifting to fair trade certification. And your name is Elizabeth O'Connell.
Yes, and you focus on fair trade, not
fair
free trade.
Fair trade.
So it's okay. A lot of people get that mixed up.
You know, why don't we start off on that? Because we've had several conversations over the years about fair trade. And I just wonder, because it is getting so much more attention, how have things changed in the fair trade world in the last, say, 5 years?
There's definitely been a lot of change in the last 5 years. Whereas before, fair trade was largely very small companies working directly with artisans in other countries. In fact, that's how it's got its start. We're starting to see a lot more mainstream company interest in fair trade, and that is largely because consumers keep asking for fair trade options and wanting to know more about how those companies are sourcing.
And can you just give us a description? What is fair trade exactly?
Sure. So I like to say fair trade is both a movement and a way to identify products. It's a movement for social justice, for solidarity with the workers making the products that we purchase, and it's also a way to classify or identify products that have been made in ways that align with social justice. So you can look for labels on products that will say that they're fair trade certified.
So Elizabeth, how strong is this movement within the environmental movement in the United States? Because one of the campaigns you're involved with is the Hershey campaign. And I was really surprised to read that 42.5% of American chocolate sales come from Hershey's. Is that
that's true? They, in fact, are the biggest chocolate company in the United States. And they're also one of the biggest chocolate companies in the world. And they purchase, Hershey is not alone, but many chocolate companies purchase cocoa from West Africa, specifically the Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast makes more than 40% of the world's cocoa. And it's a country where child labor, especially in the agricultural sectors, is far too common. And it's exacerbated by these companies finding a very cheap way to source their cocoa. And largely consumers don't know about
this. So how people in the West can put pressure on such a huge company, such as Hershey's, through these campaigns to change their corporate behavior, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great approach to get companies to change. We saw that with the Hershey campaign. We campaigned for 2.5 years, largely Green America members and other consumers who were concerned about this joined us in signing petitions and taking action on social media, joining us for demonstrations at the Hershey stores and even at their annual shareholder meetings. And over time, that got their attention, and they even started to notice changing in purchasing. So they, after 2.5 years of campaigning, have committed to go 100% ethically certified by 2020. So we do think that consumer pressure works.
So right now, about 200,000 children are forcibly working on cocoa farms. How will their lives change once Hershey becomes 100% certified?
Yeah, the hope is that by purchasing certified cocoa, more money can go to the farmers who farm cocoa for a living, and they won't have to rely on the help of forced laborers or child laborers, so that then those children can go to school. A lot of companies are also putting money into building schools in West Africa, so that'll be helpful too once there are more schools for these children to actually go to.
And sticking with chocolate, because so many of us love chocolate, I noticed that even in the natural health food stores, like half of the bars are fair trade labeled, the other half say organic, non-GMO. Does that mean that they're not fair trade? And if you care about these issues, how can you find out, well, in this case, really, how children are treated on these farms?
Yeah. It's a good question. Unfortunately, within the organic standard, there aren't any requirements relating to labor, so you can't assume that it's better for the workers. One thing that is better about organic certification is that no pesticides were used, which is a huge problem for farm workers. So that at least is a good thing. But to really understand how the workers were treated with cocoa, you want to look for fair trade certified.
And the other thing is that what you just said, Rose, I've noticed that a lot of products, food products here today, have non-GMO label on them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about a product whose seeds, for example, has traveled thousands and thousands of miles, right, and ended up in a drink here, how can you say for a small company or a nonprofit that's making a drink here, how would they know that seed was not GMO?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to trace.
Right.
With cocoa, we're lucky in that there's been no approved cocoa production that can be genetically modified. It's not a
product on the market. However, within a chocolate bar, there are things like sugar or sugar beets that could be genetically modified. So as a consumer, you do want to check. But for companies that want to know for sure that something's not genetically modified that might be, they usually go through organic or non-GMO verified processes to make sure.
So because we have all these labels, right, necessarily, I'm not just talking about big corporations that are not labeling, but the other thing is that we do have labels on a lot of health food that we see, and they are really not verifiable because they are not regulated as well.
Yeah. I mean, for smaller companies that care and know that their consumers care, they go the extra effort to find out, and they work with organic certified or non-GMO verified, or sometimes they go and visit their farms because they really want that relationship with their farmers.
Because I was going to ask a similar question. A lot of us in the U.S. can't really see the benefits of fair trade practices going into effect because so much of the food is sourced in another country. So in the case of chocolate, when you're talking about West Africa, how are these rules enforced?
Yeah, it's hard with cocoa because we can't grow it locally. You can't get locally sourced cocoa. We have to buy it from other countries, and it's hard to enforce in a place that's so far away. And cocoa farms are way off the beaten path. They're like way into the jungle. They're not like a farm like you imagine here in the United States. It basically looks like a jungle, and there's just cocoa trees growing amongst the jungle floor. So it is hard to enforce, but the farms and the cooperatives that sign up to work with a fair trade certification agree to work under different principles, and they get audited on an annual basis where someone comes and checks. And then, you know, we also as customers want to hold the companies accountable to make sure that they're actually paying the farmers fairly, and the certification monitors that as well.
So how big is this business in the United States, fair trade chocolate, for example?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I know that chocolate industry overall is more than a $10 billion industry worldwide, and it's only growing because as people in countries like China and India become more wealthy, are able to afford a luxury good like chocolate, which largely the United States is no longer a luxury good. We all can afford to buy chocolate. So as that changes, there's more and more demand for cocoa. There's more and more demand for cheap cocoa, and that will impact farmers. So as an educated consumer, it's important to make sure you're choosing the right products that align with your values.
I'm just curious, what makes cocoa a cheap cocoa, and what's a good quality? What's considered to be a good quality cocoa?
Yeah, well, when I said that, I kind of meant that you're paying a price for cocoa that doesn't represent the actual cost to making that, the work of the worker is not being accounted for, and they're not being paid what would be considered a fair price. But within cocoa, there is definitely different quality grades, and if you're buying a higher quality chocolate, like a really good quality chocolate, it will demand a higher price in the market. So that's good too. It's placing a premium on an agricultural product that normally doesn't earn a lot of money for the farmers.
You're listening to a special broadcast. We are live here at the Green Festival in San Francisco. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan, and we are joined by Elizabeth O'Connell, Campaigns Director at Green America. It's a nonprofit working to build the green economy. And Elizabeth will be speaking on the main stage today at 4 o'clock. It's a post-film discussion of the film GMO OMG.
Mm-hmm.
What is that about?
Well, it's a
love
film
the name.
About one father's pursuit of trying to understand what are GMOs and how can I keep my family safe from them. His name's Jeremy Seifert. And we're going to be screening it here. And it's a great place to come see it because it's not out and available to the public yet. So we hope that a lot of people will enjoy that at 4 p.m.
Well, since we're talking about this film, you are also involved with the nationwide campaign to label GMOs. And the GMO initiative 522 in Washington State was just defeated. It was also defeated here in California last year. In Washington, Monsanto spent $4.6 million to defeat the labeling initiative. DuPont spent $3.2 million, altogether $11.1 million. And then on the yes side, they raised $950,000 coming from Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps. Why are these labeling laws losing?
Oh, I think it's largely because of the money that you were just pointing to, and even more companies spent millions more and billions more. It's because with all that money, they can really create confusion for consumers so that they don't understand what the labels will mean, or they think that the labeling will cost them more to buy food, and that's simply not true.
So where does the movement go from here? Because things often happen first in California, and then activists say, all right, we've learned from their mistakes, let's do it different this time. So what did you learn from California and Washington State?
Well, I don't think, in Washington State, they haven't they haven't claimed defeat yet. The campaign is still waiting to see as the votes come in.
Because that's all a mail-in mm-hmm. ballot state. The yes. whole state votes by mail.
And I right. think it's yeah. King County they're waiting on, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they said that they'll have an update on Tuesday after Veterans Day. So we're still hoping that it could pass there. But it's just because they haven't passed in California and Washington doesn't mean that we've been defeated. This issue, again, has been brought to a national level. Consumers are asking, what are GMOs? And then saying, oh, my God, I can't believe this is in 75% of the food we're eating. So every time we're able to educate more consumers, it just builds the movement. And ultimately, I think we will win because we have the power of consumers on our side who want to know what they're eating.
And I saw your blog at GMOinsight.org. Mm-hmm. It's quite a valuable resource. It's GMOinsight.org. And there was a blog post about Elizabeth Warren.
Yes.
Actually pushing or suggesting guidelines for...
labeling.
For GMO labeling.
At the federal level.
At the federal level. And I didn't know that there is actually a push on that level.
Yes, there's
So can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Senator Warren, Senator Boxer from California, along with Congressman DeFazio from Oregon, have proposed a bill for federal labeling of GMOs. So it's great that that exists. Other senators and congressmen are starting to support it, and Elizabeth Warren announced her support earlier this week, so that was good news. But it still needs a lot more support, so we're, again, trying to build awareness about that. And everyone listening can call their own representatives, urging them to sign on to this bill.
We have seen the continuation of the revolving door between Monsanto executives and the White House. Mm-hmm. You can name the corporation and it continues, right? I wonder, when you look at these kinds of issues, what has really changed under the Obama administration?
I don't know if I'm so prepared to answer that question, as Green America really focuses on solutions in the marketplace, because we think sometimes our government isn't quick enough to act on these issues. So I'm pretty frustrated with the situation as it stands right now, which is why we're trying to find solutions directly from consumers to businesses.
Because I was surprised to read that these General Mills and these big food corporations, mm-hmm. they actually support labeling non-GMO food. So can you talk, because this is really, really interesting how they are also confusing the issue more by creating a sort of a counter label.
Yes. I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is another thing that's really confusing consumers. General Mills came out in support of a federal non-GMO labeling policy. And at first you think, oh, they support this on a federal level, just not state by state. But really what they're saying is we are okay with putting the burden on normal food makers. And this totally doesn't address the issue of the fact that we're eating GMOs and not knowing about it. So again, it's confusing to consumers.
So can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So again, it's a federal voluntary system to label non-GMO food. So that means that the non-GMO food in any industry, when a new GMO is introduced, say apples, if suddenly a GMO apple comes onto the market, non-GMO companies would be allowed to voluntarily say, I'm a non-GMO normal apple. Again, that placed the entire burden of proof onto the non-GMO normal apples.
There's not going to be enough room for all these labels eventually.
No. Exactly.
I mean, really. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up non-GMO apples, because we're going to talk about that later in the show. Mm-hmm. There was actually a campaign to try to prevent McDonald's from using GMO mm-hmm. apples. Mm-hmm. The first GMO apple in the country. And it was because the campaign was so successful, McDonald's pulled out. But I thought, really, a GMO apple?
Yeah, they've proposed, in fact, it's already been working on an apple that won't brown when it's exposed to air. So that's better, because consumers don't want to have brown apples. But really, who cares? I mean, I'd rather have a real apple.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that with you and our next guest, Dana Pearls with Friends of the Earth. She's going to join us in just a couple minutes. We're joined right now by Elizabeth O'Connell. She's campaigns director at Green America. And if you're just tuning in, this is a live special broadcast from the Green Festival in San Francisco. It's taking place right now at the Concourse Exhibition Center south of Market at the corner of 8th and Brannan, just a quick walk from BART and Caltrain. And we'll be here until 2 o'clock with a number of social justice activists who are working to protect the planet and ultimately humans also.
People and planet.
And I wanted to talk to you also about fair trade clothing. I think this one's really important, especially in light of the tragedy in Bangladesh, which killed 1,100 people, mostly young women. Not much has really changed since that tragedy. Walmart, H&M, Zara, all of these companies have really failed to take action. Now, I have to say, I love the Green Festival because it's full of fair trade clothing. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites is Blue Canoe, mm-hmm. and heavily discounted. So you can get like a jacket for $30 yeah. or a fair trade skirt made in San Francisco for $25. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the state of fair trade clothing?
Yeah, it's a new and emerging field in a way. Actually, it's broad is what I'm trying to say is because when you're thinking about clothing choices, there are so many options. There's things to think about local or from abroad or union made or secondhand. And there's lots of good options out there, which is a good thing. But because the apparel industry is so big and complicated, it is so hard to trace and know where your clothing is coming from. So again, looking for a fair trade label or union made or just choosing to buy secondhand, those are all good options.
Because necessarily when you buy something that's American made, it does not mean that it's fair trade. Because I remember we did a show about what happened in Bangladesh and this mm-hmm. whole concept of fair trade clothing. And there have been raiding, the FBI has raided some of these sweatshops, yeah. some sweatshop in Los Angeles, for example, yeah. in New York. Mm-hmm. And where I was working in LA many, many years ago, in front of my office, there were a number of garages that mm-hmm. had been turned into like huge warehouses where there were women working there, and they would bring down, you know, shut mm-hmm. the shutters were down, and then for lunch, yep. you know, they would just come out, eat, and then they would go back in for the rest of the evening, the day. So when it comes to local, mm-hmm. domestic versus, yeah. what additional precautions or information that people need to yeah. know? Because I see more labels saying made in the USA, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure exactly what that means.
Yeah, no, it's good. You're a consumer that's asking questions, and that's what we all need to do when we buy anything. And made in the USA, in a lot of ways, that's good because it's keeping business in the U.S., but it doesn't tell you enough, just like you're saying. It doesn't tell you who made it or where. So what I would do is, you know, if I'm looking at a company or a product, is just ask even more questions. Made in the USA, how and by whom? And even though our labor laws here are stronger and more enforced than other countries like Bangladesh, it's still not perfect. So it's still important to be a consumer that's paying attention.
Is it a clearinghouse, a website where people can go and find out more information about the stuff they're consuming?
Yeah, within garments, there are a few to check out. Like, there's a website called Know the Chain that helps you understand the chain of production. You can also find better options just by going to like Fair Trade Federation, where there's a collection of businesses that are making fair trade clothing.
And it's pretty safe to say that almost everything here at the Green Festival is fair trade.
Yeah, fair trade, or if it's U.S. made, sometimes it's hard to get the fair trade designation because that's more for countries making things abroad. But it does mean that they've gone through a screening process that shows they're committed to environmental and social justice, and that they went through that screening process with the Green Business Network.
And some of the vendors here are very small, mm-hmm. Businesses, and I think they produce their own goods and they're selling it here. This is sort of direct from
direct trade, which is important.
So that's a very important. I think that's what I really like. One of the things that I like about Green Fest is that you tend to see people that are innovative, they're entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, they're just
and connected to their
they're
communities.
Connecting to their communities and. It tends to be a little bit more expensive, but you know that directly it's going to the person who's producing these goods, which is, I think, really, really important.
And unlike the women in Bangladesh, what were their hourly wages?
They make roughly $37 a year,
like
a month?
A month, right.
Yeah. yeah.
And a dollar a day, I mean.
And the sad part is that their children actually continued with the work. The parents who were perished in the fire, their children had to take on the job that they used to do because they still cannot afford making a living.
And the families of those victims still are waiting for
compensation, and they have hospital bills now, and they're at 22 cents an hour.
Yeah.
But something that happened, I think, in Bangladesh, which is important, is that there has been a push for unionization of workers.
Yeah, that would be great to see. In the United States, there was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which led to a lot of reform, so I hope that happens.
Major protests. That is Elizabeth O'Connell. She's campaigns director at Green America, a nonprofit working to build the green economy. She'll be speaking here at the Green Festival on the main stage at 4 o'clock. It's a post-film discussion of GMO-OMG. Yeah. And we are live at the Green Festival. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan. And the Green Fest is happening today or until 7 o'clock tonight. Tomorrow, 11 until 6. Admission is $15 or $10 for students and seniors. You can get in free if you ride your bike, if you're a member of the Sierra Club, Global Exchange, or Green America, or if you bring in a receipt from Rainbow Grocery. And now I would like to welcome Dana Pearls to our broadcast. Dana is the food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth, an organization representing more than 2 million activists in 74 countries. Dana has run regional campaigns in agricultural counties to ban cancer-causing strawberry pesticides, to label GMOs, and to help reform the corporate control of our food systems. Hi, Dana. Thanks for stopping by.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So I wanted to ask you what we were talking with Elizabeth about earlier, the GMO labeling crops that went down just in Washington and in California. I mean, there was so much money behind them from Monsanto and multinationals that own organic companies, which people are now learning about. But why do you think these crops go down besides the money? Is it misinformation? What do you think, or what?
I think the elections are bought, so that takes care of the money. I think that in the campaign work that the opposition does, there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of consumer confusion, and there's a lot of fear tactics being used. And ultimately, a consumer and a person wants to make the best decision about how their family is going to be best benefited and what's going to be healthiest. And I think that there's also so much information that oftentimes people are paralyzed, and it's often safer feeling to take no action than action.
And it's interesting what you're saying is because I think even media is part of this as well, because we're still treating genetically modified organism or product as something that is not harmful. And there is always that role of a skeptic, like is this happening, or sort of this false equivalence that we give to both sides of the issue. So scientifically, the same thing that's happening with the climate change, I think, is also happening with GMO as well. That there is a 50-50, you cannot make a definitive decision. So when it comes to what scientifically has been proven, or what people have experienced as a result of consuming, or for farmers planting GMO seeds, what's out there to point to the direction that this is harmful for us and we should not take it?
Yeah,
or we should stop and do enough research so we can come up with something conclusive and then say whether we can consume it or not. So what would you say to people who have questions about GMO products?
I think there's a lot of information that is coming out based on the experience of farmers. You can look to India, you can look to Mexico, you can look to countries all over the earth that have been trapped into using genetically modified seeds. Farmers who can no longer seed save, farmers whose crops have been contaminated, farmers whose crops are not drought resistant and are not benefiting and are having to use even more pesticides. You can talk to, or people have spoken with the pesticide vendors and said, in the past 20 years, how have the sale of your pesticides gone? Given the input of these GMO seeds, are you selling fewer pesticides? Because supposedly the use of GMO seeds reduces the need for pesticides. And the data strongly shows an increase in use of pesticides. So the data in terms of farmers and the impact that this is having is out there and is very clear. I think the reason that we have an issue with data on health and data on the consumer is that the research isn't being done. In a similar way that we have fewer organic tools than we do chemical tools, you know, related to the farm bill, there's not a similar amount of money being put into organic research. Likewise, the reason that we don't have information is not because we can't get it, or not because the outcomes are confusing, but because we're not doing it.
So universities are not supporting
this sort of
research?
That's not where the funding is. The funding is coming from companies like Bayer and DuPont and Nestle and PepsiCo, and those are the companies that provide the funding for the research, and they're not asking for the research questions that you are asking.
So who is doing the research?
I think a lot of the research for genetically engineered organisms comes from within the companies that are doing the production themselves. The problem with genetically modified organisms and GMO seeds and GMO foods is the onus of the burden is on the company itself is the one to provide the research demonstrating the safety of the product, which is unlike anything else. You would never have a financer or a company do its own financial audits. That's illegal. But for whatever reason, while a company can't do its financial audits by itself because they'll cook the books, a company can do their own research audits, and there's no independent assessment. That's one of the biggest problems that we're seeing, not only for genetically modified organisms, and why we're calling for a precautionary principle, but we're starting to see it with biotechnology in general, including where genetic engineering is going, headed down the road of synthetic biology.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in just a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you both, and again, that's Dana Pearls with Friends of the Earth, and Elizabeth O'Connell is with Green America. It was so fascinating to watch the campaigns unfold in California and Washington State, because a lot of people who eat organic food had no idea that their favorite company was owned by a multinational. I just want to apologize for the loud noise in the back. We're broadcasting from the Green Fest, and sometimes we don't have control over that. But a lot of people were shocked to see my favorite small company is owned by Kellogg or Clorox, in the case of Burt's Bees, or Toms of Maine. What do you think about this trend? Because it feels like the companies that are not owned by multinationals I can name them on both hands. There aren't that many left. So, Elizabeth, what do you think of this trend?
Does
it matter?
Well, it does matter. I mean, as a consumer, I want to have full information when I'm purchasing something. And even if the product is organic, and it's good that there are these organic options still available, I still want to know if the money I'm spending is trickling up to these larger corporations. So, like, while I do think it's good that General Mills has offerings like Cascadian Farm or Muir Glen that are organic, it's still important for consumers to know who, in fact, owns those companies.
Do you think people should still buy from the small company if it's owned by a multinational?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you're looking for a product that actually is organic and that's your main concern, then I think you can still buy it. But if you want to make a greater statement with where your money is going, then I would choose to put my money elsewhere to support the companies that are fully committed to a sustainable world.
So when these big companies buy these little small companies, does the price of the product come down, or still, because there is always this argument about these big corporations are, because they're producing in mass, they're willing to provide cheaper consumer products, as opposed to someone who has a really small company.
Yeah. Well, and the other important question is, does the product change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't speak broadly about that, but I would say no, the price of a product like that doesn't come down. Just because they can maybe use economies of scale, they still know it's a premium product that consumers are willing to pay more for. So I wouldn't say that that's happening on a large scale. And your point about the products changing, that does happen. When a company takes over a smaller company, it's case by case, but some companies lose their own independence within that company to say what goes into their product or how it's made. So you do have to ask the questions again.
Well, I want to thank you, Elizabeth. I know you have to take off. Thanks so much for joining us. Elizabeth O'Connell is Campaigns Director at Green America.
You can check
her out at the Green Fest today at 4 on the main stage. She'll be hosting a post-film discussion. I really want to see this documentary, GMO-OMG. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Green Festival. And Dana Pearls is food and tech campaigner with Friends of the Earth. What are your thoughts on this trend of seeing these small companies being bought by multinationals?
I think that in addition to what Elizabeth tapped into, what it comes down to is a lack of transparency. And this is perhaps one of the most upsetting things for me, whether it's in an election or it's on products or it's behind a political campaign, is a lack of honesty and transparency on what is going on. Where is the money coming from? Who is backing this? What company is backing that? The fact that you can pick up a product and not know that it was ever bought by something larger, or you can pick up a product and not know what's in it, or where is the money coming from? It's a lack of transparency, and it's a facade, right? I think that Burt's Bees is a local organic brand, perhaps, and maybe I just don't know. And I have a facade of choice, when actuality, I don't have any choice. And so I think that taps into the bigger problem. As a consumer, do I actually have a choice? In order to have a choice, I need to know what it is I'm choosing between.
The other issue that you're involved with is SynBio. And that is also changing our food system in great ways. The market for SynBio is estimated to be $2.4 billion this year and $10.8 billion by the year 2016. Can you give us some basics about exactly what this new science technology.
And this is synthetic biology.
This is synthetic biology.
Yeah, so synthetic biology is a bit of a creepy term. Ultimately, it is extreme genetic engineering. A lot of people know what genetic engineering is, the idea that you're taking one naturally occurring gene and inserting it into another natural organism, right? Synthetic biology is ultimately where genetic engineers have gone, right? Genetic engineering is no longer static. It has skyrocketed to the other end. So synthetic biology is where you type in the DNA sequence which you would like to create, whether it exists or not, doesn't matter, because we have now broken down the DNA sequence of most all plants. So rather than depending on two organisms to produce what I'm looking for, I can say, well, I want a specific DNA that has a combination of these sequences. I type it into a computer, I print it out using what is called a DNA printer, and I can inject that into algae or yeast, which serve as little mini factories ultimately, and I can reprogram that yeast to produce whatever product I want. So for example, one of the biggest products that there's a couple that's already out on the market, but the biggest, most widely used product is a flavor and fragrance that we know as vanilla. And vanilla is has now been engineered using computerized DNA and yeast cells, and is possibly going to be coming to the market as early as this 2014.
In ice cream?
In ice creams, in beverages, in cookies, in your cupcakes. The idea is that synthetic biology is moving us away from the dependence on nature. We don't need nature to engineer the life that we want to create. It is extreme genetic engineering. It's genetic engineering, and this is important, is very relevant, and we need to know that it is constantly changing and evolving. And so this is why it's important to understand synthetic biology. We're looking at vanilla right now. In the pipeline, there's other food products, saffron, ginseng.
Saffron?
The biggest one Unilever is invested in Brazil, and they just sealed the deal on a multi-billion dollar agreement with a biotech firm is to work on producing a replacement for coconut oil.
I'm very particular about saffron, because Iran is the best producer of saffron.
Well, what you have is the idea is that their food products, and there's, you know, petroleum products, they're products that are expensive. And when in the case of vanilla or coconut oil or saffron or ginseng, these are high value products. And oftentimes they're high value because they're grown sustainably. There are millions of small farmers who are able to actually make a living from these products. What if we could produce them in a vat? What if we could produce them in a way that we don't need those small farmers anymore? And as fast as I can say copy and paste on my computer, I can produce that.
So if a country like Iran or Spain, they patent their saffron, is patenting a way of combating and fighting these unregulated, genetically engineered markets?
It is one way, and in that way, we're seeing courts weigh in on genetic engineering. We're seeing courts weigh in on what has come up as a big moral issue. Can we play the role of what some people would consider to be the role of God or Mother Nature? Can I create, because there are plenty of biotech firms that do now, can I create a brand new, unique, novel genome that exists nowhere in nature, and can I patent it? And now I can produce it. And so it's a moral issue. Should we be able to do that? Do we have the right to do that? And it's the commodification of nature that gets brought up.
We're speaking with Dana Pearls, a food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth. We're broadcasting live from the Green Festival. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan. Malihe found this good story because I hadn't read much about synthetic biology from Organic Matters blog, and it says that these corporations have spent no money on environmental risk assessments. Large agribusiness, energy, chemical, cosmetics, and flavoring companies are investing billions of dollars in this technology. Other uses, we're talking about grapefruit flavor, orange flavor, those are already in commercial use. So have these been tested? Are people eating this already? No. And how can we find out if we're eating this?
So one, yes, it is in products. Orange and grapefruit are the two. So vanilla has not come out yet, and we're trying to block it from the market ultimately. And the way that we're doing that is through consumer campaigns and also working to try and get any sort of federal regulation. As of right now, there is zero language in any government agency internationally, not in the U.S., not internationally, that addresses synthetic biology. We don't know how it will be labeled. The companies producing synthetic biology ingredients are trying to have them labeled as natural. In the U.S., genetically modified organisms is based on the product. If it's produced via a process that's highly engineered, that doesn't matter as much as is the product itself engineered. It's very wonky. There's a loophole that basically is we're fighting to close a loophole which would allow a synthetic biology produced product to be labeled as natural, because this is going to throw the natural food market and natural market in general into a whirl of chaos, which is why this blog came out. You have consumers who are trying to make a choice, who are trying to be accountable, choosing something that says natural, and in fact it's computer generated. So what we have, in the same way as consumers are starting to reject genetically modified organisms, and we see that in every poll that is taken across the nation. Consumers do not want genetically modified foods to go unlabeled.
What about countries that actually depend on these commodities to, you know, for example, vanilla, cocoa, saffron? All these commodities are really, really important to many countries in terms of how they trade.
Well, I think this opens up another question. So in the same way that the GMOs are being rejected by consumers, so will synthetic biology. But we need labeling, and we need to go beyond it being a consumer issue, right? We talk about, a lot of people talk about the impact on health, but genetic engineering has huge impacts on farmers, it has huge impacts on ecosystems, on economies, and when we talk about synthetic biology, we need to be talking about, as Elizabeth brought up, we need to talk about fair trade. We need to talk about entire economies like Madagascar's economy and that depends on vanilla or the saffron industry. What is this going to do? What is the ripple effect of countries across the world, not just what is on our plate in front of us?
That is Dana Pearl. She's food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth, and I'd love to hear our next guest's take on this. Kevin Danaher is executive director of Friends of San Francisco Environment, which works to create a more socially equitable and sustainable city. He's helped found a number of green-focused organizations, including Global Exchange and the Green Festival. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Great to see you.
Hi, Kevin.
You know, I wonder what you think about all of this. The synthetic biology, GMOs. I buy chocolate and there's five labels on it. I mean, what? How is the average citizen supposed to keep up with all this stuff?
Well, the labels are going to go away. What you're going to have is a little scanner on your cell phone, on your handheld device, and you'll scan a barcode, and you'll be able to download. You already got Good Guide. Good Guide has over 10,000 products that they've done all this rating, and it's either green, you can buy it, orange, be careful, or red, don't buy it.
Red but what?
This is a code.
You'll turn blue if you buy it.
Well, oh, I see.
They're testing it for environmental impact, health effects, social justice, whatever. And then that way, because this is really about information. It's about labeling. It's about letting the customer know. As was pointed out, most people...
So, Kevin, I have to spend all day just scanning things.
Right.
Well, if it's
I have work to do.
Exactly.
If it's something that you're going to put into your body or on your body, it probably makes sense to pay a little bit of attention to whether it's going to give you cancer in 20 years.
So we always come back to this question over and over again. What is government good for? What are all these agencies good for? And why do we keep saying that we have to support FDA, we have to support EPA, we have to support all these agencies which are supposed to guarantee that not just we in San Francisco, but people in Mississippi and Tennessee and other places in the world are eating well and they're not
going to get sick
stuff in their bodies.
The problem with the regulatory state under capitalism is that corporations are not stupid. They see which agency is going to regulate them, and they try and take over that agency, right? So if you're a transportation corporation, you want to get control of the agency that controls transportation. If you're a food company, you want to get control of USDA. There was a person at USDA who put out an email saying Meatless Monday might be a really good thing. The beef industry got on Vilsack so heavily that Vilsack had to disavow the whole thing and say, oh, no, that's not an official thing. Okay, so if you look at where change actually happens, where progressive change is happening, it's at the local level. And I'll give you one example. The Kyoto Accords, Clinton and Gore wanted to sign it. Republicans wouldn't support it in Congress. We never signed on as a nation. There's about 900 cities. We did a chapter in one of our books about this. There's about 900 cities in the U.S. and all 50 states that have signed on to Kyoto or some equivalent for reducing climate impact because they realized as we reduce our waste, we save money. San Francisco, the taxi commission in San Francisco already beat their targets for Kyoto targets for 2020 because a guy on the taxi commission, I met the guy, he's a really smart guy, he realized, wait a minute, if we go to hybrids and electric and natural gas and go away from this petroleum-based fuel, we'll actually save money. So, yeah, and so what's going on now that's sort of magic and part of this global values revolution is you're developing economic models, enterprise models, where you make better profits saving nature than destroying it. That's a tipping point. The cost of fossil fuels is going up. The cost of renewable energy is going down. Federal Government Energy Department issued a report a couple months ago that one-third of all U.S. electricity could be produced by waves and tidal movement. And the technology exists. It's just the political will and the investment to get this stuff put out there. The entire country could be powered, electric of the United States could be powered by a section of Nevada, or four states in the Midwest have enough wind energy potential to power the whole country. So the critics always say, oh, well, look at renewables. They're a small percentage of the total. That's a good thing. If you're in enterprise, you want to be in a market that's not saturated, where the future growth curve is really steep. And that's why the enterprise model needs to be taken away from the corporations and done by people like us. And because global exchange, we have stores, we have tours, we do events, they all make money. I call it financial sustainability instead of profit. But the questions are, did you exploit people or nature in producing your product? And then second, where do the profits go? Do they go into your third mansion and your car collection or some bull? Or does it go back into the work, back into building the movement? It's not the enterprise model. It's the way in which the enterprise model has been taken by corporate capitalism and turned into a dominate nature, dominate people, do sweatshops, pollute the environment. The enterprise model itself, me speaking as a nonprofit person, it's great to have stores that raise their own money, events that raise their own money, book publishing that raises its own money. We do reality tours to Cuba. We did 45 reality tours to Cuba last year. They make money. If done correctly, they make money that then you can buy new computers and you can hire people. And the people who are going on the trip, they're happy to pay that fee because their life is getting revolutionized by a society of 11 million people that managed to survive 60 years of economic embargo and aggression by the United States. And they went completely organic as a country. And they're doing all, they did a thing in 2006 in Cuba where they said, everybody who's got old appliances, bring them in and we'll give you new appliances, because they calculated that the country as a whole would save money. Now, that's an aspect of a command economy. We were always told, oh, communism, command economy, it's all bad. But if you want to vaccinate all the children, or you want to replace all of the appliances for energy efficiency, a command economy is really a cool thing. We don't have that here, right? We've got a fragmented society.
Kevin Danaher is Executive Director of Friends of San Francisco Environment, and he helped found the Green Festival, and we're broadcasting live from the Green Fest. He's author of 13 books, including his latest, The Green Festival Reader, Fresh Ideas from Agents of Change. We're also joined by Dana Pearls, a food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth. I'm Rose Aguilar, here with Malihe Razazan. And Dana, before we let you go, we love having Kevin on because he always gives us these positive stories that are happening across the country that we just don't really hear much about. And I was checking out Friends of the Earth website this morning, and you're all doing so much work. You've got a campaign about bee-killing pesticides, a 2013 cruise report, which includes the best and worst cruise lines. You're currently running a campaign to tell Carnival Cruise Lines to stop dumping sewage into the oceans. How prevalent is that still?
Oh, it's incredibly prevalent. Yeah, I think that companies want to have a positive brand. Companies don't want their brand to be one of contamination. And so ultimately, what our campaigns are trying to do is say, hey, we are going to break brand loyalty because we're going to expose these negative practices, or we can lift you up as a leader of this industry by going in the direction that Kevin is describing, by investing in different forms of energy, by replacing your machinery, which is cleaner, to not dump your sewage directly in the ocean, to commit to not buying plants that are using neonicotinoids, which are the bee-killing pesticides. So we're trying to work as much as possible with companies to take a turn in the right direction.
And you have a success story. You were telling Gerber, an apple producer, to say no to GMO apples, and you succeeded. I had to read that twice. I had never heard of GMO apples. Well, but I guess strawberries, so what's the difference?
So the GMO apples are not yet out on the market. What we're trying to do is stop some of these products from ever getting onto the market by blocking them before they could ever get approved. So if McDonald's, which is one of the main companies being targeted for this GMO apple, says, we don't want it, then the company is going to be in a difficult position.
Who came up with the idea to create a GMO apple?
It's a Canadian company, a Canadian fruit company, and ultimately the idea, it's purely cosmetic. There's no nutritional value added, but the idea is to create an apple that will never brown. But unfortunately, you're messing with the DNA and of the apple, and there's extensive research that shows that by silencing the browning gene, you compromise the system, the defense mechanisms of the apple, so they are not as likely to fight off diseases, and they're not as likely to protect themselves from pests, which means that you're taking the fruit which uses one of the most amount of pesticides, and now that you've compromised its immune system, you now need to use more pesticides on them.
But we can scan them.
That's right.
Right, Kevin?
You can scan the apples.
We can scan the apples and find out what's in them.
That
and everything
comes
down to zero. This is all very interesting. You talk about technology. This is something that when I went on your website, I realized how so many different environmental organizations are actually using technology. And being in the Bay Area, surrounded by so many innovative companies and people, so can you talk a little bit more about how technology is changing the environmental movement? The other interesting thing that I really was fascinated with here today was the hybrid battery. I had not seen that. I'm sure it's in the cars, that some of these hybrid cars, but it looked really, really sleek.
There are biological batteries being developed. There are people developing systems where you pump water up into tanks, and then that water coming down can run little micro mini hydro units. There's all sorts of technology happening that's really awesome. There's a spectrum regarding technology. At one end is people who are technophobes, who are like, oh, the technology, it's terrible, it's destroying us, it's making us stupid, we're 140 characters, is our literacy. And then there's people at the other end who are like, technology is going to save us. Oh, it's so wonderful, we don't have to do anything, we can just sit back and let technology fix everything. Clearly, there's a place in the middle that realizes technology is just a tool. A hammer can build a house or it can bash somebody's head in. We've seen throughout history, the pesticide industry came out of war. It was chemical nerve gases that formed the basis. They said, oh, gee, if this stuff can kill people through attacking their nervous system, it can kill bugs, too. Let's have it, you know, and you get this huge industry. You know, prior to the big world wars, there wasn't chemical agriculture. It was all organic agriculture. Thank you very much. In Cuba, the younger generation of agronomists who wanted to go organic, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 89-90, and no more petrochemicals, those younger agronomists who wanted organic got together with the old peasant farmers who had always been growing organically because they predated the introduction of petrochemicals, and they went organic as an entire country. So it's more about how does the technology mediate social relations? Is it a corporate tool for dominating us and turning us into mindless consumers? Or is it technology that we use to liberate ourselves? And just think how the internet is making the economy go this way, laterally. I'm moving my hands from side to side. And the ruling institutions are hierarchies that are structured vertically with all sorts of layers of decision-making and approval, where people at lower levels are worried about what's my supervisor going to think. That's anti-innovation. It's anti-creativity. So here's the magic of our age. I'll summarize it this way. What is the world that is really sucks. Children starving, environment, biological collapse all around. What could be is amazing in terms of all the technology, the renewable energy, et cetera, et cetera. So when you get people to realize, look, we don't have to huddle in the dark, powerless, thinking we're screwed. We can actually fix these things if we get organized. And that's the key thing. It's community organizing at the local level, crossing institutional boundaries, because you need government to pass law, you need for-profits to do investment, and you need nonprofits to do the education and activism. When you get those three collaborating, that's why San Francisco is so green, because you've got good collaboration across institutional boundaries.
Kevin Danaher is Executive Director of Friends of San Francisco Environment, and I know you've got to leave soon because you're going to go speak.
Yes.
But I have to ask you, because you live in San Francisco and we're talking about technology, what do you think about the changes that are happening right now with San Francisco? Twitter being valued at $18 billion, out-of-control rents, mass evictions. What do you think about what we're dealing with right now?
The big problem is housing, right? We have people being pushed out of our town. Our police and firefighters and teachers can't afford to live in the city anymore. So I'm working on a real estate model that would use city property and school district property to have permanent green festival, Green Mart Eco Mall on the ground floor, and then affordable housing for teachers, police, firefighters, muni drivers, city workers, because the financial model, and I've got developers and architects and engineers on board on this, the rents would come in at about 50% of normal rents, because what you're doing is you're doing a land lease where you're paying the owner, the city or the school district, $1 a year land lease, and you're taking that saving and passing it through to the teachers, cops, firefighters, whatever. in terms, you know, the rents come in at below 50% of market rate rents. Look at, you go to any city in the country and you got a problem of city workers not being able to afford to live near where they work.
Right.
So there's a big problem and there's a real easy solution, and we just got to get the politicians on board.
What's the status of your project?
I've got the architects, the designers, the engineers, the technology is all there, the financing is there. It's the political piece of getting the owners, who are school districts and cities, but think, that model could be rolled out to every city in the country.
And when are you going to be the mayor of San Francisco?
Oh, never, I hope.
You should run.
Run to the border, maybe.
Thank you so much,
Kevin.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. Kevin Danaher is Executive Director of Friends of San Francisco Environment. He helped found Global Exchange, Fair Trade USA, and the Green Fest. He's going to be speaking in just a couple minutes. I love the title of his talk. I wish we could have asked him about this. How can we be good ancestors taking action now for future generations? Something we need to spend more time talking about. I also wanted to thank Dana Pearls, food and technology campaigner with Friends of the Earth, an organization representing 2 million activists in 74 countries. Dana is giving a talk right now at Stage B called Inside GMOs, a Survivor's Guide. GMOs are getting a lot of attention here.
A lot of attention.
Yeah.
A lot.
So we are broadcasting live from the Green Festival. I'm Rose Aguilar here with Malihe Razazan. And the Green Fest is taking place at the Concourse Exhibition Center south of Market at the corner of 8th and Brannan. It's just a quick walk from BART and Caltrain. And you can find out more at greenfestivals.org, Green Festivals with an S. We will be here for another hour. Green Fest runs tonight until 7, tomorrow from 11 until 6. Admission is $15, $10 for students and seniors. Those under 18, bicyclists, members of the Sierra Club, Global Exchange, or Green America can get in for free. You can also get in for free with a receipt from Rainbow Grocery. We've been here, gosh, Malihe, this is our fourth or fifth broadcast.
I can't remember anymore.
Yeah. It's nice to come here because there are a lot of really exciting things happening within this movement that don't often get the attention they deserve. And it's also nice just to find out, you know, why did the GMO labeling law go down to defeat again? What is happening with the fair trade movement?
There are so many different food companies here today.
Yeah, you're excited about that.
I was
all
very
vegetarian
excited.
And vegan,
They're
I should
very
say.
Vegetarian, vegan. But at the same time, it shows that people want to eat well.
Yeah.
But I always have this question that whether this is sort of a local phenomenon here or this is a more national, global phenomenon, because we have all these competing forces. One is spending so much money to defeat all these labeling laws. On the other hand, you have people like Kevin and all these wonderful activists we have here today who are really challenging all these corporations and the non-regulatory sort of space that we are living in. So it's really interesting to see, and I have to say there are more vendors. I mean, this place is more crowded this year than it was last year.
It's growing. I think there's so much more awareness now.
There is.
People are finding information. If they can't find it in their media, if they live in the middle of the country, I mean, we're lucky here. They go online and they're finding amazing documentaries and amazing talks. So that's on the positive side. And I just want to mention you are listening to KALW San Francisco.
And now I want to welcome Farah Obeidullah. I pronounced it correctly,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Farah Obeidullah is an oceans campaigner with Greenpeace in West Africa. The newly opened office in Senegal focuses on fisheries across the region, exposing the impacts of overfishing on coastal community. And Farah, you work with Greenpeace.
Yes, I do. I'm based in Amsterdam with Greenpeace International.
You are with Greenpeace. Actually, we said that in the introduction, in the beginning, that you're coming here all the way from Netherlands. But what was very interesting reading about, especially fisheries in West Africa, mm-hmm. that how much overfishing is going on in West Africa, and how little attention it's getting, and the role of these multinational corporations and countries such as China. Mm-hmm. Can you take us
sort of give us an overview of why this is such an important issue that we need to pay attention to?
Yes, sure. I mean, overfishing is a global problem. We're seeing around the world that, fish stocks are being exploited, overexploited. At the moment, the UN, United Nations, estimates that up to 80% of our global fish stocks are in trouble. And so this is not a problem exclusive to West Africa. Unfortunately, the problem with West Africa is that there's very, very little in the way of enforcement, very little in the way of good governance to manage fisheries properly and to ensure that that foreign fishing fleets don't come in and, exploit and plunder and take all the marine resources. These resources are extremely important in countries in West Africa, as they are in many developing countries around the world, because millions, if not billions, of people are dependent on fish for, their basic protein, for their income, and also for their food security. So in West Africa, you know, it's just one area where Greenpeace has been focusing on in the last few years, and we established an office in, Senegal.
Tell us more about West Africa, and why is it so popular, and, why is it being so overfished?
Well, it goes back quite a few decades, but it's not too far, sort of geographically speaking, from Europe. And the problem is that Europe has already overfished many of their resources. And instead of managing their fish stocks and ensuring that the fish in Europe recovers, they have just been building bigger and better vessels and fishing further and further out to sea and in different parts of the world. And West Africa, being sort of quite, you know, relatively close to Europe, has been an unfortunate victim of the European fishing fleet, but increasingly also in the last couple of decades from fleets coming from East Asia. So China included.
And as you, we said, you live in Netherlands, and you have successfully led a campaign to prevent the introduction of hydraulic dredging by Dutch company in Mauritania. Can you talk about how Holland fits in this overfishing in West Africa, and, why this campaign was so crucial?
Sure. I mean, the Netherlands, although it's a small country, has a significant fishing fleet. And it's actually one of the bigger producers of fish, but also bigger sort of hubs through which fish is traded globally. The Netherlands also has one of the largest fishing fleets in the world, with fishing vessels reaching 140 meters long and catching hundreds of thousands of fish. These vessels don't have any, you know, many places to fish anymore in Europe, and so have, you know, been expanding their geographic range to West Africa, but also to the South Pacific and, other areas of the world. So with this case of hydraulic dredging, the campaign, it was actually, well, hydraulic dredging is an extremely destructive practice.
Yeah, can you tell us about that?
Sure. It's basically, it's a practice where you're essentially sort of bulldozing or dredging the sea floor. You're destroying everything on the sea bottom to catch, in this case, shellfish. And they had been doing this for about 25 years in the Dutch Wadden Sea. And despite sort of years of campaigning, it took the European court to ban that practice in the Netherlands. And so what this company then decided to do with their sort of industry was to transfer that industry to Mauritania under the guise of development aid for Mauritania. So they were trying to get this activity subsidized by the Dutch government and under the guise of people, planet, profit, so a sort of sustainable way of doing things that would also benefit the country in terms of economic growth and
so these are like massive vessels. Mm-hmm. And to try to visualize this in another way, it's almost like a bulldozer going through a neighborhood and destroying everything in its path, right? That's what's happening in the ocean.
That's right.
How common is this practice at this point? And where is it banned, and where is it still happening?
Unfortunately, it's banned in very few places. I mean, there's different types of trawling, but the most destructive trawling is what's called bottom trawling, and that can essentially destroy corals that are thousands of years old in the deep ocean, where people have typically thought nothing much lives. And that happens out at sea, typically in sort of international waters. But what we're also seeing is a lot of bottom trawling in coastal waters. And this example that I gave about Mauritania, the main problem there is not just about the environment. It's not just that you're destroying you know, beautiful habitats, but you're destroying also the base of the food chain. Mm. And the people, particularly in developing countries, depend on the oceans for their very survival. And in the case of Mauritania, they wanted to dredge in areas where the octopus thrives. And the octopus is the main staple for and main export for Mauritanian fishermen. Mm. So about 30,000 fishermen were dependent on dependent on octopus as their sort of main form of income. And if you start dredging their food source and their habitat, you're essentially destroying these people's livelihoods.
Because something that we have seen, for example, with global warming and how it impacts communities is that a lot of people migrate to places where they can do agriculture or they can do fishing or they migrate into cities. So when it comes to West Africa and Mauritania in specifically, what happens where people are not able to sustain their livelihood through fishing, for example, for octopus? What happens? Do they go into cities? How does it change the landscape around those areas?
Sure. Well, it has an enormous impact on communities. So it can vary from people really risking their lives, going further out to sea on their small pirogues, which are absolutely not equipped to deal with, the open oceans. So what you hear and what I've also heard directly from people that I've met in various parts of West Africa is that, you know, family members are lost. You go out to sea and the chances of returning are small. And then in addition, it's particularly in Northwest Africa, so Senegal, Cape Verde, Mauritania, but many other countries as well, you see this sort of flow of people trying to get to Europe to find sort of new opportunities and employment. And so it's really tragic because obviously Europe wants the fish, but they don't want the people. And so you get a huge problem of refugees.
They have tragically lost thousands of people. They have tragically lost their lives.
That's right. I mean, we saw not long ago, we saw
the journey.
Hundreds of people dying, drowning out at sea because the boats trying to make it over to Europe are just
so
not...
So approximately, how many people have been impacted by this?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I know that there are about 3 billion people that are dependent on fish for at least part of their protein intake. Yeah, so around the world. And in terms of sub-Saharan Africa, I'm not quite sure of the numbers, but we're talking millions of people that are actually solely, sort of exclusively dependent on fish for their protein. It's hard to give an exact figure, but we're talking a lot of people that are affected by overfishing and destructive fishing.
We're speaking with Farah Obaidullah. She is an oceans campaigner with Greenpeace. They're focusing their work in West Africa. She's based in Amsterdam. And Farah will be speaking tomorrow at 3 o'clock on Stage B, giving a talk called Oceans Adrift, Plunder, Profiteering, and Collateral Damage. And we're broadcasting live from the Green Festival here in San Francisco. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan. Can you talk about, to kind of picture this globalized fish market? It's so massive. And I always think about this incredible documentary called End of the Line. Mm-hmm. And this documentary interviews all of these scientists who say if we continue eating fish at this rate, they are going to be gone by the year 2045. Mm-hmm. What does your data tell you?
There was some, the data varies depending on which scientists you talk to. But, one thing is very clear. We are talking a very short sort of time span between now and the time where it will be impossible to get commercially, where fisheries are commercially viable. That could be anywhere between 50 to 60 to 100 years. And it all depends on how we decide to manage our fish stocks and also how we decide to manage our oceans generally.
Paint us a picture of this globalized fish market. What changes are you seeing? I mean, where is most of the fish going at this point? I mean, I think about the Bay Area, tons of sushi restaurants. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of our listeners eat a lot of fish. And so talk about how they're all, what role do they play in this also?
Yeah. The problem with fisheries today, it is overfishing, but it's also a lack of transparency. It's difficult to know where your fish comes from, how it was caught, who was impacted by it. And that is something that we are, you know, campaigning on around the world for increased traceability, for, you know, combating illegal fishing, as also known as pirate fishing around the world. And yeah, the main sort of producers or consumers of fish are unfortunately depends how you look at it, but it is countries like the USA, it is northwest Europe, and also
China.
Asia. That's right, and that's an increasing problem. Their fleet is enormous, but also the appetite for seafood is just increasing around the world. And,
right.
And so what I can say is I can encourage people, for example, in the Bay Area. I'm not from here, but I can encourage people to really sort of question where their seafood comes from. Make sure that, you know, if you're going to a restaurant, make sure that you look up restaurants that source sustainably and source locally as well. That's really important.
Because I just got an email alert this morning from Oceana, and they've done tests on local sushi, and they have found that 3 out of 5 times the restaurant actually lies about the fish that they're selling you. So, I mean, if you're dousing it with, you know, soy sauce and wasabi, I mean, I don't eat fish, so I don't know if you can tell the difference,
mm-hmm.
but you might not be eating what you're told you're eating.
That's right, and that's why it's even more important that, you know, you really do your homework and research. Avoid fish at all, if possible.
Do you eat fish?
No, I don't. I have fish occasionally when I'm offered it by people in, for example, in communities in West Africa, but I also know then that it's locally sourced. But I try to avoid fish altogether. But coming back to what you can do, you can... sort of avoid fish. If you want to eat it, you can make sure, or you can ask where it's sourced, because at the end of the day, retailers and restaurants are only going to change the way that they source fish if there's a demand for that. And that's why it's really important that you know, everybody, people, start demanding a change in the way that their seafood is caught, just like you would want, you want to know where all your other food comes from.
So what's happening in Holland? We were just talking about genetically modified organism and how difficult it is to get this just mere labeling passed
in
the United States, as we have had one last year in California and this year in Washington. Both of them, millions of dollars was spent by companies to defeat this. How is it in Holland, for example, both in terms of awareness, mm-hmm. that people, how aware are they about what they eat, mm-hmm. or ask questions, or when you have a campaign against these multinational ships that go and overfish from West Africa? Can you paint a picture about the level of activism and influence that your campaigns have in a place like Holland as opposed to United States?
Well, I mean, Holland. First of all, Holland's a very small country.
Yes,
compared
this is a continent,
you know,
by itself.
This, exactly.
Yeah.
The Netherlands is about 17 million people.
Yes. So half of California.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you know, it varies. And Greenpeace has been around in the Netherlands for 30 odd years. On some campaigns, it is about awareness, but it's also about, you know, providing solutions or alternatives. I think there's people are very sort of particularly in developed countries, they've been hearing about environmental problems for a very long time, and so they also want to hear about what they can do, and that's become a challenge for organizations like Greenpeace as well, because sometimes there just isn't, unfortunately, an alternative available right now. On fisheries, Dutch people in general don't eat that much fish, so there is a huge campaign by the Dutch government to increase fish intake by Dutch people. So obviously, you know, we are sort of trying to be one step ahead and say, well, you know, be careful where you get your fish from. There is, you know, more labeling coming around about, you know, sustainability of seafood. Unfortunately, there's still many gaps. It's not a perfect system yet. But like this case in Mauritania, you know, we were successful in mounting enough pressure in the Netherlands as well as in Mauritania to get the Dutch company to back down.
So when it comes to campaigns, you working in Netherlands and activists here that you see are working here on the ground, what kind of lessons do you guys share with each other in terms of what works in connecting because at the same time, at the end of the day, it's really about solution.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can give people to use to change their habits, to connect with their governments, their communities, and all that. What goes on behind the scene when you guys get together and have a glass of wine and talk about your experiences?
Yeah, it's interesting because there are a lot of cultural differences between countries and the approach that you take in terms of activism. And I've been working on oceans issues for about 10 years now in different parts of the world. And it is fascinating to see what works in different places. For the U.S., it's... there's still some very sort of similar tactics, I think, that we use in Europe and the U.S. In terms of raising awareness and offering solutions. But in other countries, like in West Africa, it's really about, owning, or how should I say this, it's really about getting the people to understand how it's affecting their lives and empowering them, because, ultimately, it's up to the people to make that change. I mean, in the U.S. and in Europe, we have choices. So we can look for alternatives. We can stop eating fish until we know that there's a fish, or stock that is sustainable, that is locally caught, that we can eat. But in other parts of the world, that's just not an option. And so it really is about empowering people and getting them to ask their governments to change. And we've been very successful last year in Senegal, for example. The incoming president, Macky Sall, he made a commitment as a result of pressure from local fishing communities to reject the licensing of foreign trawlers. So he basically withdrew the license of 29 Russian trawlers in Senegal because we mobilized, we helped the fishing communities in Senegal to mobilize themselves and to empower them to actually demand that change from the incoming government. It is something that, it's a different approach depending on where you're campaigning.
We're speaking with Farah Obaidullah. She is Oceans Campaigner with Greenpeace. She's located in Amsterdam. They do a lot of work in West Africa. And she'll be speaking tomorrow at the Green Festival on Stage B at 3 o'clock. Her talk is Oceans Adrift, Plunder, Profiteering, and Collateral Damage. And you're listening to a live broadcast here at the Green Festival on KALW. I'm Rose Aguilar, here with Malihe Razazan. And I wanted to mention that on Thursday's Your Call, we're going to have members of Greenpeace on the show because the Rainbow Warrior ship just arrived in the Bay Area. They're giving tours, free tours, this weekend and next weekend. You can find more information at greenpeace.org. Can you also give us an update about your colleagues who've been jailed in Russia?
Mm-hmm.
And can you give us a little background on that?
Sure. We've been campaigning to basically protect the Arctic Ocean from oil extraction for the past few years. Unfortunately, as climate change is taking its toll, thanks to fossil fuel consumption, the Arctic is melting quite quickly. And that means that it's also becoming more accessible to oil companies to drill for even more oil. And so we have been going up to the Arctic to campaign, to take direct action against companies that are wanting to drill there. And this year, in September, we actually took action against Gazprom, which is a Russian oil state-owned oil company that have a drilling facility there. And we had two activists scale the platform to basically unfurl a banner to basically raise awareness of this issue. This is what Greenpeace does. We want to raise awareness about what's going out on the sea. We bear witness. The Russian authorities based this year, as opposed to last year, they took quite reacted quite heavily to our action, and they arrested the two activists, but the following day they also seized our ship, the Arctic Sunrise, and with it the entire crew, so 28 Greenpeace crew and two journalists have been arrested since, I think, September 19th. They're held in a pretrial detention in Russia at the moment. So it's been, something like 50 days or so that they've been held. And I know from, my sort of communications with my colleagues that they are held under pretty severe circumstances.
And facing heavy charges.
Yeah, and they keep adding on to it.
They keep adding, that's right. Yeah. They were first charged with piracy, which is a ludicrous charge, given, what we were actually doing. And also the Russian authorities seized a Dutch-flagged ship in international waters, and it remains to be seen whether that is actually legal. Our lawyers and many international lawyers have said that it's not legal. And the condition, and so they were charged with piracy first, but a few weeks ago they the Russian authorities said they would drop the piracy charges and instead charge the activists with hooliganism. Now, until today, we have not actually seen the piracy charges dropped. So now they are charged with piracy, which has a jail sentence of up to 15 years, hooliganism, which has an additional 7 years, and some of our activists are being charged with even heavier, with additional charges. Resisting arrest, I believe, was one of them, which also carries 5 years prison sentence. So it's a very sort of, very difficult time, for our colleagues, but also for all of us as Greenpeace, and I think for the entire activism community, because, you know, we were staging a peaceful protest, and this is the backlash or the reaction that we get from the authorities. Mm. And it's very unfortunate that this is how activism is now, you know, sort of being perceived in certain parts of the world. In terms of the Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior, I mean, it is touring Western USA and Canada, a West Coast tour, and it just arrived in San Francisco yesterday. Mm-hmm. There will be a lot more information also about the Arctic 30 and what people can do to help our colleagues in Russia. I think the ship is located at Pier 15 and 17 at 698 the Embarcadero in San Francisco. And so I encourage people to go along, find out what Greenpeace is doing. Mm-hmm. We'll be talking about our campaigns, not only on oceans, but also forests and climate. And there'll be a lot more information on the Arctic theme.
And again, your colleagues will be on our show, Your Call, from 10 to 11 on Thursday. And so we'll elaborate on these issues.
In general, since you've been working with Greenpeace for such a long time, how effective is direct action?
And what type of direct action is most effective?
And what kind of, what type?
Right. If direct action was not effective, or if we didn't think it was, we wouldn't be doing it. We many of our victories, of our successes, have been based on direct action, and not just from Greenpeace, but also across all sort of activism. At some point, talking will only get you so far. People will only listen, once they're forced to listen, unfortunately. And so, direct action is a great way of getting that awareness, getting people to stand up, getting people to listen. And again, what I was saying earlier, the type of action that you do depends on the type of audience you're trying to reach, the cultures that you're working in. So I do believe that it is... one of the most effective ways to bring about change.
Because when something like the experience in Russia happens, that it can dissuade or create some sort of a rift within an organization of whether it's worth it to mm-hmm. have somebody spend 30 years or four people spend 20, 30 years or in jail, or when you are in water spaces of countries that are quote-unquote really, really unfriendly. Being Iran or Persian, if this thing happened, for example, in Persian Gulf. So that could sometimes dissuade people from, groups from doing direct action. That's what I was asking. That.
Well, I mean, I can only speak for Greenpeace, but we are absolutely not dissuaded by what the Russian authorities have done. The letters that we're getting from our colleagues in jail at the moment are very encouraging. I mean, of course, they're going through tough conditions. They're, describing what the conditions, but their spirits are generally quite high, and they know that they have to make the sacrifice if they want to see the change that they believe in. I think with every successful change in our society throughout civilization, there have been sacrifices. If you look at apartheid, if you look at women's rights, if you look at many issues around the world, it has always taken some level of personal sacrifice to achieve your end goals.
We're speaking with Farah Obaidullah. She is Oceans Campaigner with Greenpeace, and she's based in Amsterdam. She focuses a lot of her work on what's happening in West Africa, specifically with the overfishing situation. We're broadcasting live from the Green Festival here in San Francisco. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan. And I wanted to, because you're from the Netherlands, what are your thoughts on the environmental movement in the U.S.? There's so much attention around the Keystone XL pipeline, fracking. We're actually going to do a show about the global movement against fracking on Wednesday. Well, you're here to speak at the Green Festival and to raise awareness about overfishing. What are your thoughts on the environmental movement in the U.S.? What do you think they do right, and where can they do better?
Well, you know, one of the big, on the international stage, one of the big things that I think the whole global community is looking to the U.S. for is a change in the policy on climate change, right? You know, we would like to see the U.S. take more of a leadership role in combating climate change, in bringing back fossil fuel use. I mean, it's you know, Obama could do a lot more in terms of ensuring that we're not going to be drilling in the Arctic,
right.
Ensuring that, you know, we are sort of taking tougher measures on fracking. And that fracking is becoming more of a global issue as well. And the role the U.S. can really play is one of leadership. I mean, there's a lot of innovation in the USA, also on environmental, in environmental technology. And so I guess I can only speak personally, but I would like to see, you know, more money, more investment go into the renewable technologies that the U.S., I think, are leading on, but unfortunately are not sort of, you know, leading on enough so that they replace traditional fossil
fuels. So looking at environmental movement, and as you said, from Europe, so you see U.S. leading in renewable energy. Oh, it's interesting.
Well, I mean, I don't...
Because we are looking at Europe from here.
Right, yeah. I mean, I unfortunately don't see it yet, but I believe that the U.S. could lean on it, because there is a lot of technology here, a lot of possibilities when it comes to solar energy, or when it comes to, you know, you have a lot of land.
And a lot of innovation.
And a lot of innovation, exactly. So, it, you know, the U.S. could take a leadership role on renewable energy, and that's what I would like to see, being from Europe.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Farah.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for your work. Farah Obaidullah is an oceans campaigner with Greenpeace. She's based in Amsterdam, working on raising awareness about overfishing in West Africa. It's hard to believe this, but there are, 4 million of these vessels trolling the bottom floor of the ocean around the world. As she said, it's almost like a bulldozer coming into your neighborhood and wiping out everything in its path. But a number of organizations are trying to ban these vessels from the ocean. Farah is going to be speaking tomorrow on Stage B at 3 o'clock. Her talk is Oceans Adrift, Plunder, Profiteering, and Collateral Damage. And you're probably hearing people clap. We're live from the Green Festival on KALW. I'm Rose Aguilar with Malihe Razazan. The festival is taking place right now at the Concourse Exhibition Center, south of Market, at the corner of 8th and Brannan. It's just a quick walk from BART and Caltrains. Admission is $15, but if you're under 18, if you ride your bike, if you're a member of the Sierra Club, Global Exchange, or Green America, or if you have a receipt from Rainbow Grocery, you can get in for free. And the Green Festival is taking place until tonight at 7 o'clock and tomorrow from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m.
And now we are joined by Doria Robinson. Hi, Doria.
Hi.
You remember me? I saw you at the protest.
Yes.
Which one?
Chevron.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were there. I was there trying to get you to come on the show the next day. Doria is third-generation Richmond resident, California, and the executive director of Urban Till, a community-based organization dedicated to cultivating a more sustainable, healthy, and just food system. Urban Till currently coordinates 11 small farms and gardens across Richmond and San Pablo. They are all rooted in communities where they are located. And she is speaking today at Stage 4.
Stage A at 4
p.m. at the Green Festival. And the title of her talk is From Richmond to Ecuador, Fossil Fuel versus Community Courage. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
I went on your website last night. I was amazed by how many gardens you have.
Yeah, and actually the number that you have is actually an old number. We have 13 now.
Wow.
One of them
it was amazing.
Yeah, right? It's funny how much you can grow if you grow slowly and from the ground up.
Well, your website says, and maybe this is outdated, that your farms grow over 10,000 pounds of food for the community.
Absolutely.
That's
and that,
incredible.
You know, farms are, the land is productive. And if given the right conditions, you can actually grow a lot of food. It really underscores the idea that our problems with hunger have nothing to do with our ability to grow food or the availability of food. It has to do with other things altogether.
What I liked about looking at your website was that to see so many kids holding like onions and cabbages and
kale.
And I was thinking to myself that when these kids work with soil, when they grow food, when they cultivate it, and then when they eat it, how does that change their own relationship with food? And when they go back to their homes, how does that change the family's relationship with food?
Yeah. I mean, when a kid spends over 3 months nurturing a plant, it becomes something utterly different than what we see in the grocery stores, these packaged kind of processed things. I mean, it becomes this life force, this thing with a story, this thing that has things that they forgot to do, like, oh, I forgot to water that day, how will it do, you know? And then when they actually get a chance after all that time and all that effort to actually taste it, and then it tastes different than all those things that they had in the stores. It's not like the vegetables, you know, the tomatoes or the carrots, that whatever, that have been sitting somewhere being stored forever. It's sweet and it's, you know, delicate and has all these different kinds of flavors. It's a radically different experience. They are in relationship with that food in a way that you just can't buy.
And I love the fact that you hire youth in Richmond, and not many youth in the Bay Area have these kinds of opportunities. You grew up in Richmond, and you have said in many interviews that there were not opportunities for you to lead anything until you left your community and went to college back east. Can you tell us some stories about the youth, especially the troubled youth that you work with?
Right. The options for the youth that we're, with the youth that we're working with, are primary youth from the flatlands of Richmond, from the Iron Triangle, from Santa Fe, from North Richmond, the hardest hit neighborhoods. Everybody knows somebody who's been shot, who's been killed. They maybe have seen it, they maybe have been there. Chronic stress, extreme chronic stress. And the options for you, if you're trying to do something different, is maybe if you're lucky, you can get a job at Taco Bell. You know, maybe if you're lucky, Target or Walmart might hire you, you know?
And that's it.
That's it. Literally, that's it.
Or join the military.
Right. Or join the military if that's something, if you don't have a record, you know.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's pretty extreme. I mean, I think the last number I saw for black and brown boys, youth in Richmond, unemployment rates was 17%. And that's who they're counting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's who actually makes it onto those roles.
So how do you decide when and how to intervene and absorb them and bring them into this farming?
Yeah, we don't even decide. I mean, there is so much demand for the few places that we have in our program that it spreads like wildfire. We can't advertise on a big way, or else we get thousands of kids.
Wow.
You know, right now, last year for the 40 slots that we had over 160 applications. And, you know, and we only control 20 of those slots. The 20 are controlled by the city. And so it's just, it was so few opportunities. I mean, we're so happy and proud to be able to hire 67 kids each summer to run the gardens and to do our programs and to learn, you know, how to run the markets and how to run the CSA. But it's still such a drop in the bucket, and we're hoping to actually grow out what we're doing, expand our CSA. That's actually, we're one of the finalists in the Community Green Grant today.
Oh, great.
And that money is hopefully to go to buying the equipment we need to triple the size of our CSA to service over 150 families.
We'll talk about the CSA in a minute, but can you tell us a few stories of the youth that you work with?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I mean, there's one woman, young woman this summer in particular. She actually applied for our program and she didn't get in. We can't everybody gets in. But she asked one of her cousins, you know, what should she do? She really wanted the job. So she just came and she volunteered for the first 2 weeks, because we told her, you know, people drop out. You know, it's possible, no promises. She volunteered. She gave it her all. She just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming. Her name is Classy Shepherd. And finally, a spot opened up, and she just excelled. Like, it was, she was like, I never even, you know, knew I would love this so much. You know, I never grew anything in my life. I can't cook anything. People tell me to stay out of their kitchens because I burn everything down. And by the end of the summer, she knew how to cook, you know, 12 new things. She was cooking for all the kids on the camping trip. She was leading volunteer projects, you know, with, you know, community members, telling everybody how to plant this and how to plant that and how to sheet mulch and what compost is, and just turned on, absolutely turned on. And before that, she literally said that she was just hanging around the house with nothing, and she had a young child, and she was just like, you know, there was just nothing going on for us. So, you know, it's really intense stories, you know, of people.
And the other, do you have, this is a year-round program.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of volunteers also.
Right.
We've had one of your workers who won the Brower Youth Award, actually,
right,
on our show. Her name
Tanya
is
Polito.
Tanya.
Yes.
Tanya.
Oh, she's fantastic.
She's fantastic, yeah. And it was so interesting that even her politics has started changing, because
she got
active,
yeah,
with the Chevron's protest,
and
because
so informed.
Her life was, and
right,
so informed, yeah, her life was transformed and changed, and then she started working with you. And I remember I called her to come on the show, and she said, you know, I quit there and I've just moved on and I'm doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the other thing, besides the fact that relationship with food, the sort of, it calms them and they have a different experience.
Mm-hmm.
How does this fit into creating politically, socially active members of a community,
right,
for example? What does this project,
right,
does in that case?
Well, our essential approach to the way that we interact with any person that's interacting with Urban Tilth is trying to make a direct connection to the person inside. And reconnecting them with the earth, you know, putting them in relationship in a way where you can understand by growing this food out in a public place with the sun and the stars and the air and everything that you're vulnerable.
And Chevron.
Interdependent. And if something happens, you know, it actually impacts you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not some amorphous thing that you go inside, yeah, your house and you get lost in a video game, but you actually worked on something for many, many days, many, many weeks, and then some corporation out there who's after profits decides to just spew all over everything you just did, you know, and then has no responsibility around it. That, people wake up when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, wait a minute, why do they have the right? And then they start asking deeper questions. And we do that, you know, I mean, the part of that is we need to understand how these things interconnect. And we weave it into all of our programs. You know, environmental justice is one of the central things that we teach, along with how to grow something from a seed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I remember after the fire, Urban Tilth held a press conference.
Absolutely.
And you basically held up some of the produce and say, this, yeah, is poisoned. We cannot,
yes,
eat this, and we have to throw them,
absolutely,
away.
After that fire, after 6 hours of the plume going over all of our gardens, we had to rip out every single bit of our produce at the height of our growing season after 6 weeks of working with 47 youth. It was intense.
We're speaking with Doria Robinson. She's a third-generation resident of Richmond, California, executive director of Urban Tilth, a community-based organization dedicated to cultivating a more just food system. They're currently coordinating 13 small farms and gardens across Richmond and San Pablo. And I love your story, because you went to school in, was it Rhode Island?
In Massachusetts, Western Mass, yeah.
And you decided to come back,
yes,
to live in your community,
yes,
and to change things, and you didn't think you were going to do that.
No.
So can you talk about the power of local activism and getting involved locally at a time when I know most of my friends are so focused on the Koch brothers and Obama, and then that's important,
right,
but so many people do not know what's going on in their own backyard.
Right, right.
And my friends didn't even know there was an election on Tuesday. So talk about that, just the importance of local activism.
Well, I feel like, and I've experienced, that really getting engaged locally is the best chance you have for making changes that deeply affect people's lives. Local politics, you have so much power to actually create the world that we need to live in. And then, you know, with time, after you've gotten what you need to have on the ground locally, you actually have the base you need to do the national or, you know, statewide or whatever, you know, work. I mean, it was really hard for me to come back to Richmond because we're always taught that, you know, you got to get out, you got to get out, you got to get out, you got to run, you know. There's nothing, and nothing ever could good could come from Richmond, you know. Nothing. I mean, nothing ever did come good from Richmond. But the problem with that is if we run from all these problems, if we run from things like Chevron, then they're just allowed to grow. It's like a cancer that's allowed to grow, you know? It's like we actually need to go back. We need to hold people accountable. We need to hold these things at bay and call it what it is. If it's something that's not working for us locally, then it's definitely not going to work nationally. And we need to stop it where it starts.
When I came to that protest, which was part of the 350.org
at Chevron,
it was something that was very interesting to me was, at first, it was a very, very friendly environment. And people were talking to the police. They were actually having a conversation as if they knew them. So I realized that because you have been working so closely on Chevron, and you have been working within the community, you have even created a relationship with Chevron,
right,
and with the police and people, the security offices. They were talking to each other about, why are you here? What needs to be done? They were actually having a conversation about Chevron with a police officer. So that's the other thing about community that creates built confidence.
Exactly. That's the beauty of a small town, is that you literally get to know everyone. So yeah, I know the police chief, Chris Magnus. It's amazing to have him as a chief. He's created a completely different policing environment. And before, you know, like, I would never imagine that we would have a positive relationship with police. Anybody I know. But it's you know, that's the power of living in a small town. And really, I mean, I see Chief Magnus at the cafe every Sunday when we do our market stand, and he buys, you know, soap and food.
And it felt like that.
Yeah.
That there is a close community.
Right.
And I should correct myself, because I was talking about the Koch brothers at the national level, but the New York Times had a really good story about how the Koch brothers are getting involved in local politics. And I just remembered that. So.
Yeah. That's a whole other story.
That is. That's for another show. Doria Robinson is executive director of Urban Tilth. They currently coordinate 13 small farms and gardens across Richmond and San Pablo. And we're broadcasting here at the Green Festival in San Francisco. It's a special broadcast on KALW. I'm Rose Aguilar, here with Malihe Razazan. And now we would like to welcome Leila Salazar-Lopez to our show. Leila is the program director at Amazon Watch, overseeing its programs and campaigns to defend the Amazon and advance indigenous rights. Hi, Leila. Thanks for stopping by.
Hi.
Hi, Leila.
And you're going to be speaking today at 4 o'clock on Stage A. Your talk is From Richmond to Ecuador, Fossil Fuels versus Community Courage. So why don't we start off by talking about that? Because you've got communities in Richmond and Ecuador battling Chevron. Richmond is suing Chevron for damages and safety violations for the refinery fire last August. Ecuador is being countersued for compensation they won for oil destruction in the rainforest. So how are these communities working together?
Well, from Richmond to the Amazon, Chevron is the corporate bully. And here in the Bay Area, this is a corporation that has caused so much harm and so much devastation. And, you know, they're based in San Ramon, which is a pretty middle-class, affluent community. And even there, you know, they consider themselves a good neighbor in San Ramon. They consider themselves a good neighbor in Richmond. And, you know, this is a company that doesn't just operate in Chevron, in Richmond and in Ecuador. They operate in 180 countries around the world. I mean, this is one of the biggest corporations in the world, one of the most powerful corporations in the world. So we're up against a lot, but it is what we're talking about this afternoon is the power of the community to you know, win our rights and respect and justice for the environment that you know this corporation has caused so much damage to.
Last year, profits for Chevron were $71 billion, This year, second quarter profits were $5.3 billion. Have you both been to Ecuador? Can you talk about that experience? Because Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin got some media coverage. She recently traveled there. And she said, quote, "I personally witnessed the abuses and contamination of the rainforest perpetrated by Texaco, now Chevron. Crude oil was dumped in the rivers and streams and on the roads. As there is no running water in the region, so families were forced to drink, bathe, and cook with poisoned water from streams and rivers." And there was a photo of her with her hands covered in oil, because that's what she found when she put her hands in the river. So because we're so disconnected physically from those 180 countries you just mentioned, what does it look like? What does it smell like? Layla?
Well, yeah, I've had the basically going down to Ecuador and seeing what Texaco did, that's why I'm here today. I mean, I went there the first time in 1995 as a college student, and I had no idea at that time that there was oil in the rainforest. I went there to volunteer at a biological station, and I was so appalled and so heartbroken and so infuriated for what this company had done. And at that time, the lawsuit against Texaco was just beginning. And, you know, when you go and you really experience, when you go to the Oriente, which is the northern, northeastern part of the Ecuadorian Amazon, what you see is a toxic legacy. What you see, you don't see a pristine rainforest. You see roads that were once covered in oil and toxic, you know, crude oil. You see toxic formation water. You know, you see oil that, you know, what Texaco did basically from 1964 to 1993, basically what they did was they drilled and dumped. They entered the rainforest. The Ecuadorian government gave them permission to do whatever they wanted. You want to build a road here? Build it. It doesn't matter if it's indigenous people's territory. Build a road, build pipelines, build oil platforms, build drilling wells, and drill what you wish and just dump it wherever you want. And that's what they did. They left hundreds of unlined waste pits in the middle of the rainforest. And anytime it rains, because it's a rainforest, those pits would overflow. And, you know, there was, and what has that resulted in? An environmental and social and cultural nightmare.
And there are even plans for more oil drilling in Ecuador. Actually, President Correa has said that resources from new oil drilling will help reduce poverty in the Andean nation, you know, in Ecuador, with a portion of these resources going to develop areas where new oil blocks are located. So how does the government really, on the one hand, they need revenue, so, and they have oil, so they just go for oil drilling. On the other hand, you're talking about all these contaminations that's going on. So what is the regulation like? Because I was reading about rivers being, like, completely contaminated with oil and tars. And so what is the government doing to alleviate this issue?
Well, you know, this what Texaco, now Chevron, did in the Ecuadorian Amazon, they basically, you know, they set the standard on how oil development should be done in Ecuador. And any company that followed basically did just what they did. They drilled and dumped. They didn't, you know, re-inject toxic wastewaters, which are boiling waters full of toxic chemicals, arsenic, mercury, cadmium. They didn't re-inject those into the ground. They just dumped them. And people drink that water. And there is a, you know, cancer outbreak. Chevron will tell you there's no cancer. We didn't kill anybody. They don't deny that they devastated the Amazon. What they'll say is it was a fraud. We were unfairly blamed. It's actually the people who live there. We're counter-suing them. With the government now is actually taking a stand against Chevron. Thankfully, President Correa's government is the first government who has ever taken any consideration of the people who live out in Oriente.
What has actually changed under his government?
Well, in terms of oil development?
Or just for the people's lives, have they seen changes?
Honestly, a lot of the change that has happened in the Oriente has not necessarily been because of the government. The government has taken a stand against Chevron because the government was actually sued by Chevron as well in an arbitration court. Chevron has sued anybody and everybody who has ever spoken out against them about what they did in Ecuador. So they've also countersued the government.
And we should say that Chevron has been ordered to pay $18 billion in damages for pollution and destruction in the Amazon. But Chevron's refusing to pay. They're accusing the Ecuadorians and their lawyer of fraud and bribery.
Yeah, and they said that they're going to fight this judgment until hell freezes over. And they have all the money in the world to do that. And luckily, right now, I mean, the Ecuadorian government is taking a stand. They have an international campaign trying to get people aware about what Chevron did, because Chevron has to pay for what they did. If they don't, every other corporation in the world is going to think they could just get away with murder. So, unfortunately, what the Ecuadorian government is doing, though, is saying, we can do it better. We have oil under our soil, and we have to develop it because we have poverty. We have to develop it. We have to get oil out of the soil. And what they're talking about is drilling in the Yasuni National Park, which is the most biodiverse place on the planet. And right underneath Yasuni National Park are an accompanying area of up to 8 million hectares of land. This is all indigenous people's territories, and they're adamantly opposed to oil development on their territories because they've seen what Chevron has done. And the government now has the southern part of the Ecuadorian Amazon up for auction and has announced they're going to drill in Yasuni. So,
8 million acres, right?
Yeah.
Leila Salazar-Lopez is Program Director at Amazon Watch, and Doria Robinson is Executive Director of Urban Tilth in Richmond. Just quickly, Doria, talk about your experience in Ecuador. What did it look like? What did it smell like?
So I had the great opportunity to go to South America, Ecuador, for the first time with Mayor McLaughlin. I was traveling with her, telling the story for our local Spanish-language newspaper, The Voice. It was profound. I mean, I've never been to the South American rainforest before. So I'd been to Guatemala, I'd been to, Belize, and seen that rainforest, and this is on a whole other scale. This is like 100 times, the grandness in the pristine areas, right? And then you go to, we visited just one of the over 800 pools, these unlined pools of contaminated water that were dumped by Chevron Texaco. And you go there and literally it's an area of devastation. You approach and it reeks of fuel, and this is, as we're approaching this, you hear the words of Chevron in your head that says, they have this mantra that we cleaned it up. And you walk into this space and it smacks you in the face, and there's just like, you can smell the gasoline, you can smell the fuel, you can smell the petrochemicals. And I also went on, these pools were kind of covered half-heartedly with soil. And so they kind of act like a waterbed, You touch them and you can kind of stand on them, and they kind of move beneath your feet kind of thing. And then you can stick your hand down in it, and literally you pull your hand out and it's covered in crud, in crude. And you do that, and you come out, and you hear the words of Chevron, we clean this up. And you're like, really?
Were you able to talk to the locals? And what did you hear from them? What message did they want you to send back?
Yeah, so we had dinner one night with some of the folks that were party to the very large lawsuit of Union of Affected Peoples. And I think universally the message was that they were just profoundly rocked by, this 40 plus years of contamination. Their lives were devastated. People lost children. They battled cancer. Their whole way of life is just profoundly changed.
Being in Ecuador, mm-hmm. and seeing what has happened to those community changed your activism and what you were trying to do here in Oakland? Because it's always about connecting global to local.
Right.
So how did that experience change you in the way that you wanted to deal with Chevron in your own community?
And we have just about a minute left.
Okay, so as quickly as I can, I think that there's this message, this kind of idea of translocal organizing, that we can gain more power by organizing ourselves one local location to one local location and then standing together, although not always in the same physical place, but in the same mental and heart place, and really stand up to these kind of new boogeymen, these new giants of our world today, with these multinational corporations that seem and feel like they're above the law, that are above any law, and they're not accountable to anyone. So each one of us, standing in our own homes, rooted in our own spaces, can just stop there and say, no, you are accountable. You will be held accountable.
And same question to you, Layla, just quickly.
Yeah. I mean, part of that, I mean, the direct answer to that question is, that's the reason why, I mean, since 2002, we've actually been working in coordination with, you know, Richmond Progressive Alliance and Richmond Greens, and when Mayor McLaughlin was not the mayor, we've been supporting each other. Anytime we brought Ecuadorians to the Bay Area, we always went and visited Richmond, and we've been doing that ever since. And that's one of the reasons why we formed the True Cost of Chevron Network. And so I encourage people to go to truecostofchevron.org.
Well, we'll definitely have to do a show about this, because I would love to elaborate more on these issues. Layla Salazar-Lopez is Program Director at Amazon Watch. Doria Robinson is Executive Director of Urban Till. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you
for
your work.
Thank you for all your work.
Unfortunately, sorry about that. We are out of time. I am Rose Aguilar.
And I'm Malihera Zazan. Thank you for joining us for this special broadcast of KALW News live from the Green Festival. We have volunteers waiting at our booth in spot 715. Stop by and say hello.
And I want to thank all of our guests, 5 out of 6 incredible women guests doing
incredible
amazing work.
Women.
Really. The show is produced by Becca Hoekstra. Phil Hartman engineered the show on site. Joanne Marr engineered at the station. Thanks to the Green Festival associates Richard Matthews and Susan Hageman. Our executive producer is Matt Martin. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And now we will send it back to Joanne Marr in the KALW studios.
The KALW On Air Folk Festival takes place this afternoon, 3 to 8 p.m. It's 5 hours of continuous live music performed here in the KALW studios. Two eclectic bands will kick off the festival, Tribeca Stan from New York City and Dirty Cello with cellist Rebecca Roudman. We'll also have Celtic music by guitarist Steve Bachman, Old Time with Pete and Ann Sibley, and the festival concludes with Bluegrass by Banjo Master Bill Evans and the Bearcat String Band. Join us for our on-air folk festival. 5 hours of continuous live music starting at 3 today on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Programming on KALW is supported in part by Radio